Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
So we're out here in Seattle on a power trip looking at non-traditional and new technologies for energy production. And we're really concerned about our carbon footprint. And so we have a biodiesel car for the whole trip. All right, and we got regular, that's Crisco. And high test, we're ready. Safflower oil. Dependent on foreign fuel? Not us. You drink it, Saudi Arabia. We're the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 3rd. John Hockenberry is in Seattle reporting for Power Trip. Good morning to you, John, all the way out there.
Oh, safflower oil, so good for you. Good morning, Dora.
Good morning to everyone. We're also going to explore whether China's economic problems could plant the seeds of unrest in its countryside. And John introduces us to a bucket of green goop. Yes, it's green goop, hired to save the environment. He's going to explain all that. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines. President Obama's economic stimulus package continues its way through Congress. Today it's in the Senate, and it could be a bumpy ride. Lawmakers will work to tweak it so it could grow and shrink right before our eyes. The president wants it passed with bipartisan support, and he doesn't want small details slowing it down.
What we can't do is let very modest differences get in the way of the overall package moving forward swiftly.
The president is talking to lawmakers, but also going public. He's doing 5 television interviews today. He's also taking time today to make a widely reported cabinet pick official. He'll tap New Hampshire Republican Senator Judd Gregg as Commerce Secretary. And it took some unusual dealing to make this happen. New Hampshire's governor is a Democrat with the power to pick someone from his own party as Gregg's Senate replacement. But Gregg said he did not want a Democrat moving into his seat. So the deal is that the governor will appoint a Republican who will not seek re-election. That means the Senate balance of power won't shift if Gregg is confirmed. Femi Oke is here with a look at the morning's other top stories.
Hello there. Another would-be cabinet member, Health Secretary nominee Tom Daschle, is fighting to keep his nomination on track after tax problems surfaced. He met privately with senators yesterday. President Obama is still behind him, as is Montana Democratic Senator Max Baucus.
Senator Daschle made mistakes on his taxes. They were disappointing mistakes, but it's clear that they were not purposeful mistakes.
And we'll be talking about Daschle, Gregg, and other political news in just a moment. The battle in Pakistan's volatile northwest is hotter today. Militants blew up a key bridge there, cutting off a major supply line for American and NATO troops. And in Alaska, they're on volcano watch. Geologists say that it's just a matter of time when Mount Redoubt will blow. John.
So we are in the shadow of some volcanoes here in Seattle. A reminder, the S&P starts trading at 8:25 this morning after a fall yesterday. We're asking you today as part of our Power Trip series, what's the one thing you can't give up or won't give up to save energy? The trade-offs in everybody's lives are very interesting stories about what it's going to take to make us a different kind of energy-consuming nation. Tell us the obstacles. You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Some great stories this morning.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today, senators can begin offering amendments to the Obama economic stimulus plan. We're taking a look at what may be on the table, and to help us do that is Capital News Connections' Todd Zwillick. But let's start with the latest on Tom Daschle, who has offered a strenuous apology after revelations that he failed to pay more than $120,000 in back taxes. Good morning, Todd. Is Tom Daschle really having to, as the Associated Press said it, salvage his nomination?
Well, it's unclear. No Democrat has come out against him yet. In fact, no Republican has come out against his nomination yet. So it's not clear how much salvaging he's doing or just sort of preventative maintenance right now to make sure things don't go wrong. You know, Adora, I've covered the Department of Health and Human Services for many, many years. I can't remember the last time people cared so much about the Secretary of Health and Human Services. The hallway last night, Daschle went into a meeting with the Finance Committee members last night to go over these tax issues, and the hallway was filled with media doing live shots. This is the door Daschle will walk in, walking around. There were 40, 50 reporters in the hallway. It was quite amazing. They went in for a meeting a little over an hour, and when they came out, Daschle offered this apology about his taxes. We were all standing around. So listen to this. Here's what Daschle had to say.
All of my life, I've assiduously tried to pay my taxes in full and on time. My failure to recognize that the use of a car was income and not a gift from a good friend was a mistake. When I realized the mistake, I notified officials and I paid the tax in full.
So what happens next for him?
Well, this thing's going to hang out here for another week. The Finance Committee has scheduled its routine hearing for Daschle, and it's a week from today. That's a long time for this thing to hang out there. He probably has some convincing to do among Republicans. Coming out of this meeting, I should say, all of the Democrats who were in there stood by Daschle, gave very strong statements of support. John Kerry, Jay Rockefeller, the rest of these Democrats gave very strong statements of support. No Republicans said anything. No Republicans who were in the meeting. There was one Republican on the committee who I don't think was in the meeting, John Ensign of Nevada, who said that he intends to look at this very, very carefully and investigate, that he's not convinced that this was such an innocent mistake. But he was the only one who was saying much, only Republican, by the way, who was saying much of anything yesterday evening.
Todd, I'm wondering why all the attention. Is it about Daschle's character? Is it about the issue of taxes, which I can't believe? Or is the media looking for some sort of sign of Obama pushback if this nomination goes south? And you're saying it's probably not.
Well, I think there's some I think the second point is a good one, John. There's that they might be looking for some sign of Obama pushback. But I also have to say, Senator Daschle has hit a pretty unfortunate spot in the news cycle here. We're entering the debate on the stimulus, but it's not going to be a final vote until the end of the week. So until then, there's a lot of process. There's not a lot of news coming out of the Middle East right now. There's not a lot of big world news. And to be honest, a lot of us don't have a heck of a – our editors, I should say, don't have a heck of a lot to focus on right now. And that hallway was filled with live cameras. Absolutely.
And you just mentioned the stimulus package, which obviously is at the top of the agenda this week. What kind
Yes.
of amendments do you think senators will be offering, particularly Republican senators?
Well, the potential list is dozens and dozens at this point. So you're going to see three main groups of amendments. Some amendments to cut out spending. You've probably heard Republicans complaining about spending on things like STD prevention or museums or things that – maybe not museums, but some other spending. Computers at the Social Security Administration. So there'll be Republican amendments to cut out spending. There will be other amendments to add spending that people want. I'm thinking of Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania wants to add $6.5 billion at the National Institutes of Health for medical research. Some people want more military construction. There will be a big Republican amendment on this housing provision to do something that they wanted to be in the financial rescue package earlier, and that is to use federal money for loan guarantees to push down interest rates for qualified homeowners so that you can get a 4% interest rate, stay in your home or prevent foreclosure. And then the other thing is tax cuts.
Right.
Republicans want to extend tax cuts, lower some of those rates for lower and middle class tax rates. Some Democrats are on board, so you'll see some tax cut amendments as well. Those three main areas will be the ones.
The tax cuts, do you think that's wishful thinking on the parts of the Republicans to say knock the rate from 10% down to 5%?
Yeah, it's unclear if it's wishful thinking, but it's going to be what they call a heavy lift. About a quarter of this package is already tax cuts, a lot of Democrats aren't wild about gigantic tax cuts at this point with all the spending that's going on. So I'm sure it'll get a good run around the Senate. I don't know how a vote like that would turn out, but I haven't heard any Democrats saying that they were on board with the idea of lowering the rates. I haven't heard them say that.
As always, Todd Zwillick, thanks for that update on the stimulus package debate this week.
My pleasure.
Todd Zwillick is a reporter for Capital News Connection. For better or for worse, the governors of New York and Illinois have made their choice of replacements for departed senators. Now another governor may get to make his choice. President Obama has said that he wants to appoint Republican New Hampshire Senator Judd Gregg as Commerce Secretary. But Gregg will not take the job unless Governor John Lynch, a Democrat, pledges to replace him with another Republican. New Hampshire Public Radio's Josh Rogers joins us now to explain. Good morning and welcome, Josh.
Good morning.
What are the politics involved here?
Well, for the governor, the issue is one of trying to express fealty to President Obama, who wants Judd Gregg to be Commerce Secretary, and also, smooth the waters with his party, who would prefer that he appoint somebody who is not a Republican, given that they control both chambers of the legislature and have had two pretty sweeping electoral victories in the last 4 years.
Josh, does the governor really have a choice? Will he replace Gregg with a Republican senator?
Well, they've clearly made some sort of deal. The governor has said that President Obama wants Judd Gregg to be Commerce Secretary, and that we all need to cooperate in times of economic stress, and that he's going to appoint somebody who will represent the state well. The person he looks likely to appoint is a woman named Bonnie Newman, who has close ties to both the governor and Senator Gregg. She worked for Senator Gregg as his chief of staff when he was a member of Congress. She also served in the Reagan and Bush 1 administrations. And interestingly, she also was a charter member of Republicans for Lynch and was one of the first people to back his campaign for his original campaign for governor publicly back in 2004, which was quite a big deal at the time.
Josh, I heard you say the word deal, and I'm just, I'm maybe wishing, maybe it's wishful thinking. Is there any chance that this could blow up into some kind of Blagojevich sort of governor megalomaniac kind of thing that's going to stretch on for weeks and weeks?
I think that's highly unlikely. John Lynch is a pretty straight shooting fellow, as is Judd Gregg. Neither of their inner circles are prone to infighting, backbiting, or leaking information to the press. Both groups have been pretty coy about how these negotiations have gone down, although they have acknowledged that they've all talked and that they've talked to the White House. Governor Lynch has said that he's fully supportive of Gregg's nomination and told the White House that he'd support his appointment.
So it sounds like a done deal there. Let's talk about Gregg's qualifications for Commerce Secretary. Why do you think the president may have chosen him?
Well, that remains something of a mystery to a lot of people around here. I mean, obviously, he's known as quite a capable and experienced legislator in Washington. He was, in the forefront of the negotiations on the bailout package. And, among Republicans, he's known as a leader who can get things done. A lot of Democrats here have expressed some mystification as to why Obama seems so desperate to have Gregg as his Commerce Secretary, which seems to be an intense but as of yet unarticulated desire for Gregg. And so we'll see. I mean, it depends on, of course, what sort of Commerce Secretary he is. In a lot of administrations, it's almost a patronage post. But obviously, President Obama has looked to reconfigure how his cabinet works and appointed czars on topics X, Y, and Z. And so we'll see. I mean, people seem to think that Gregg might be a good ambassador to Republicans on the Hill, and also that for Democrats in this, perhaps you get a guy who's never lost an election, has very high popularity, even though the demographics of New Hampshire have changed. Get him out of there for 2010. So maybe you kill two birds with one stone.
And how do the folks in New Hampshire feel about one of their own possibly being in the Obama cabinet?
Well, if somebody had said years ago that Judd Gregg would be quitting the Senate to join a Democratic administration, most people around here would have found that hard to believe. I think people hope that he does well by the state, and certainly at a time when all state governments are looking for money, that that might be helpful. But we'll see.
Josh Rogers, famous last words. We'll see. Thank you for your report. Josh Rogers is a reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio, and he was talking about Senator Gregg becoming Commerce Secretary in the Obama cabinet.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody, and good morning, Adora, from out here in Seattle, Washington, at the studios of KXOT KUOW live. I'm kind of on a power trip, as you know, but it has nothing to do with my psychology. No, my travels to the West Coast with a bunch of takeaway producers this week is to take a look at some new, potentially revolutionary energy technologies in their scientific infancy. And yesterday, for the first time anywhere, we got to see the dramatic rollout of a new way of growing algae in huge quantities to produce biofuels from polluted water. And if there was any way to make green, gooey algae dramatic, we were going to find it in a soaring, breathtaking, totally dull two-story office building, which is where I found Michael Weaver, the CEO and founder of the biotech company BioNovitas. I asked him how we could turn tons of green goo into something we can run our cars on.
The industry really requires three problems to be solved. One problem is a strain selection. Can we have an algae that is fat enough with lipids to really produce enough oil for fuel production? So that's number one.
So you're really looking for a gluttonous, oil-filled algae species to bring your oil along here.
Yes, and that creates its own issues because the fatter the algae, generally the slower it grows. So you want to have something that reproduces pretty quickly. This stuff divides generally anywhere between 8 and 24 hours, so it's a very quickly growing algae. So you want to have something that's not going to slow that down. So that's one part of the process. The second part is the growing process, which is essentially what we've decided to tackle, is how can we grow it so quickly and so densely that we can get 7 to 10 times the amount you would normally have if you just grew it in your backyard, for instance.
Okay, so this is the machine. This is the garden of earth-changing delights that's going to turn algae into biofuel.
It is indeed.
And nobody's seen this before.
Nobody's seen this before outside of this laboratory.
Well, let's see it.
Okay.
Here we go. I'm excited. Yeah, I'm looking at a tank full of green goo, and there's some bubbles, and
there's gold in that goo.
Wow, that's going to save the world, huh?
Now that we have this giant mass of algae, we need to actually extract all those pieces out of it. So when you say I can create tons and tons and tons of algae, the biggest issue, of course, is, well, that's great, but how does that translate into oil? And frankly, that's something that the industry has not yet solved.
So right now, there is no factory, refinery-level, Valero-level kind of process for turning tons of goopy, smelly algae into actual biofuel.
No, nothing that's been announced yet. There are plenty of companies that are working on exactly that, though. There are now, interestingly enough, there are companies that will take the algae oil and then generate jet fuel directly from that, which is very exciting. And you've seen a couple of flights recently. Japan Airlines had a flight, Continental Airlines had a flight, that utilize algae as well as other oil-based crops, crops that have significant oil content in it, used for fuel, and actually have been performing very well in the jets.
And this algae was obtained from somewhere other than the airline food.
Yes. Actually, this algae was obtained from Hawaii, this large growing algae growing region, yes. Yeah.
So a lot of environmentalists would say the future is green on planet Earth, but you would say, no, actually, it's green goop, right?
I might market it that way, absolutely. It's certainly green goop. Algae takes up a lot less landmass to grow also than existing methods of growing vegetables for fuel.
If algae is collecting sunlight at the top of a body of water, mm-hmm. as it grows and produces more algae, the sun can't get below.
That's exactly right. That's the fundamental flaw with growing algae at large volumes for biofuel production. Biofuel is actually a very low-value product when it comes to algae. There's other things you can grow algae for, like nutraceutical products that actually have higher value than biofuels. But certainly the market for biofuels is very large. The biggest problem, however, is you have to grow it extremely dense in order for it to be able to be cost-effective for biofuel production.
That means you got to grow it at the top of the water, the middle of the water, the bottom of the water, and the sun doesn't go down that low.
The sun doesn't go down that low. So existing algae ponds, for open ponds, are generally about 3 to 4 to 10 centimeters deep, and that's it. And the reason is because anything deeper than that is not going to get any sunlight anyway.
So how do you solve that?
Well, this is essentially what we've done here at Bionavitas. Each of these boards have a series of light-emitting diodes. There, as you see, it's being turned on. They're red and blue. Ooh. So red and blue is the wavelengths that the algae can most efficiently process. So we only feed it with red and blue lights inside this tank. You notice also that you have full brilliance on this panel, yet that panel is faded a bit. As the algae gets blacker and blacker, this panel is only about 2 centimeters away from the surface, you'll actually see it disappear. And that's the problem that algae has in growing at high volumes for biofuel production, is ultimately blocks its own light and can't get enough.
To do the kind of biofuel production that we would need to replace any segment of our consumption of carbon fuels, we would need, like, Lake Erie, Lake Superior-sized vessels to produce this algae, unless we have some kind of scientific breakthrough.
Currently, the United States consumes about 70 billion gallons of diesel fuel each year. If you were going to replace all that diesel fuel with the current sources of biodiesel, which are soybean and canola, soybean you'd have to plow under about 64% of the United States just to plant soybeans for biodiesel. For canola, it would be about 24% of the United States. For algae, less than 1%. About a third to a quarter of the state of Arizona, the size of Arizona, for algae. But that assumes that you can grow algae at the kind of volumes that the potential of algae has.
But is there a scaling issue here fundamentally? I mean, if it took hundreds of millions of years for biomass to become oil that has the kind of efficiency, combustion efficiency to drive these enormous machines, do we really think we can get away with doing this in a speeded up? I mean, it's cheating to think that we can do this in a matter of months, right?
The biggest problem, of course, is you're trying to compete against sort of a magic fluid. Oil is incredibly, has a huge energy content. It's very difficult to replace with a single solution. So are we going to be able to replace everything with algae tomorrow? It's not going to happen.
There you go.
Are we going to be able to replace oil with lots of different solutions, a combination of different types of power generation, fuel generation, and so on? Yes, we'll be able to ultimately do that.
So any of these kinds of solutions, and particularly this one, is still going to involve major redefinitions of fuel demand by consumers. We're going to have to change
yes.
the way we transport ourselves,
yes.
the way we heat our homes, the kinds of choices we make about energy for this to even work.
Exactly. We'll absolutely have to do that no matter what we do with it, especially if we want to consider climate change as well. We cannot be creating fuels that are essentially one-way fuels. You're digging carbon out of the ground and you're releasing it into the atmosphere.
Right.
You need to have something that's going to be able to consume CO2 from the atmosphere and create a fuel that essentially can sequester it short term.
Mike, there's a beautiful lesson here, and I can feel it. For hundreds of millions of years, algae has been our friend.
Yes.
It's time for us to be algae's friend. Is that what you're saying?
It's certainly time for us to renew our friendship, yes.
Michael Weaver, CEO and founder of Bionavitas. Adora, you can go to our website and see a tour, a video tour of the lab. That's our power trip for today.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 3rd, and Femi Okeh has some headlines for us.
And the time is 32 minutes past the hour. The White House says that President Barack Obama plans to nominate Republican Senator Jeb Gregg of New Hampshire as Commerce Secretary this morning. New Hampshire's Democratic Governor John Lynch has confirmed, and I'm going to quote here, an understanding that Gregg suggests that he would keep the seat out of Democratic hands. The same company that runs a peanut plant in Georgia where salmonella was found has also been running a plant in Texas that's unlicensed and until last month had never been inspected. No salmonella has been found there, and the Associated Press is reporting that the plant has been operating for almost 4 years. Suspected Islamic militants in the Khyber Pass area in northwest Pakistan have blown up a bridge, cutting supplies to NATO forces in neighboring Afghanistan. Most supplies for the international forces in Afghanistan come through Pakistan. Let's look at some of the top stories making news this morning.
Thank you very much, Femi. So, John Hockenberry is at member station KUOW and KXOT in Seattle. He'll be on the West Coast all week for our series Power Trip. He's taking a look at the future of energy. And we're asking you today, what's the one thing you can't give up or won't give up to save energy? And what obstacles are in place that keep you from changing? Christopher writes on our website, I drink a fruit smoothie every day. I make this in a powerful blender. If the electricity went out for a few days, I don't know what I would do. I guess I'd have to weld a bicycle to the blender somehow. I have a friend who did that. Well, there's an idea. Tell us your stories. You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. The global economic crisis has taken hold deep in China's countryside. The government made a dramatic announcement Monday saying 20 million rural migrant workers have lost their jobs because of the economic hard times. Many say the Chinese government is increasingly worried that rising job losses will cause social unrest. Joining us is Dr. Carrie Brown, a senior fellow in Asia Research at the Chatham House in London. Welcome, Dr. Brown.
Hi, hello.
20 million workers unemployed. Now, that's twice as many as was estimated just last month. What happened?
Well, I think a lot of them are migrant workers who work in the manufacturing area in the south of China. So with the disappearance of export markets in the EU and the US because of the global credit crunch, these people just haven't got jobs. So they have had to go back to their homes. And I think that this figure of 20 million is probably an underestimate. It's probably several million more.
And who are the workers blaming? Do you have a sense of that? Are they blaming the Chinese government?
From most of the anecdotes that we've been hearing, their anger has been directed at factory owners who shut the factories without paying final wages. They may be sort of angry at local officials because they might blame them for being corrupt. Corruption remains a big, big problem. At the moment, it's not directed at the central government. They realize that this is a global phenomenon, and therefore they are being patient. But that, isn't something that could kind of, you could assume would go on forever. It may be that they do start to get angry at the government.
You mentioned the central government. It issued a statement warning that 2009 will be, quote, possibly the toughest year since the turn of the century, clearly trying to prepare the population, right?
Yeah. Premier Wang Jiabao, who is the head of the government, is in the UK at the moment. And he gave a talk a couple of days ago about the big fiscal stimulus package, the sort of trillions of Chinese renminbi, Chinese currency. So I think just that will mean that they'll be able to meet their 8% target growth rate this year. But I don't think that they'll be seeing real growth in terms of exports. They've been very dependent on those for GDP growth, but that's just not going to happen in the current climate. And I think their problem is trying to build a good domestic consumption with Chinese people. Chinese people tend to save. They don't tend to want to spend. And that's got to sort of change. Although consumption's gone up 23% in 2008, there's no way that that will be able to replace the very good markets that they had abroad in the years up to 2008.
Dr. Carrie Brown, the huge irony here is for a communist state that is supposedly all about the workers, these workers that you're talking about are as disorganized as any workers in the world. Is there any chance that they will have a channel to express their dissatisfaction with the economy and the government.
Yeah, I mean, the government has always been very, very nervous of organized unions. There are official unions. Any attempts to set up unofficial unions have been clamped down. That was one of the problems 20 years ago during the Tiananmen Square disturbances in 89. I think that there are informal groups. These groups may well start to really kind of catch up with each other, you know, kind of create links. That will be very, very worrying to the government indeed. They're in control of it at the moment. But I think that the problem is that many of these people, you know, if they stay in where they're working, they could do, you know, they could sort of organize themselves better. One of the ironies is that during the Chinese New Year, many people went back to their home villages and therefore, you know, are much less likely to link up. I think the Chinese government kind of likes people to go back where they came from because then their kind of links with other workers are much, much weaker.
What can the government do, or what is the government doing to prevent the kind of social unrest they're concerned about?
Well, they're intending to do two things. One is to help people with, you know, kind of being able to spend a bit more. I think the problem is that people in China save so much because the educational facilities or the health facilities are things they have to pay for, and therefore they're always saving for the rainy day. Well, now, obviously, it's raining pretty hard, and so the government wants to put lots more money into these areas so that people feel that they don't have to save all the time and, you know, be saving for if they're ill or saving for their children to go to university. And they're also kind of doing much more to help with building infrastructure. So, I mean, the second thing is just to try, like other countries like the US and the UK, to stimulate the economy with this big package of, you know, sort of infrastructure, building projects, things like that.
Final question. Are they expecting more layoffs, more people to be unemployed?
Yes, it's going to get worse. I can't see how it can fail to do that. The exports took a really sharp dive in December last year. And they'll continue to go down because people just don't want to buy, you know, goods at the moment. That's you know, true in the EU and the US.
Not a lot of good news anywhere. Dr. Kerry Brown, thank you. Dr. Kerry Brown is a senior fellow in Asia Research at the Chatham House in London. Don Hockenberry, my co-host, is at member station KUOW and KXOT in Seattle. He'll be on the West Coast all week for our series Power Trip. He's taking a look at the future of energy and some of the innovations that are currently underway. And we're asking you today, what's the one thing you just can't give up or won't give up to save energy? And what obstacles are in place, perhaps, that are keeping you from changing? Ted in Maryland writes us an email to say, over a quarter of a century ago, I lived in Australia. In my neighborhood, nearly everyone got free hot water from roof-mounted solar power. Why isn't the same system widely used here in the U.S.? And why does it cost, he asks, so much more to buy and install compared to what it cost in Australia over 25 years ago? If you have an idea of maybe why that's the case, why don't you drop us an email? Or if you've got a story about what's preventing you or helping you to save energy, you can drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. So listen now to a sound that was once completely authentic, completely raw, and completely new.
Crying, waiting, hoping you'll come back. I just can't seem to get you off my mind.
It's been really hard these many years to get the sound of Buddy Holly out of all of our minds. He's the beginning of so much in popular music. And here he is singing right at the beginning. A boy from Lubbock, Texas. What comes from Lubbock, Texas?
Crying. My tears keep falling all night long.
He's not even 20 years old here. More than half a century later, the Holly sound is the score for Hollywood stories Buddy could never have imagined. The movie Juno, about a snarky, rebellious girl keeping her out-of-wedlock baby, seems made for this anthem. Please don't Buddy Holly still feels new and rebellious. The Juno soundtrack has been on Billboard's top soundtracks list for more than a year. But back in the 1950s, the sound of Buddy Holly was something so different, it was kind of hard for showbiz Yoda, Ed Sullivan, to even introduce them on television.
And now, oh boy, with Buddy Holly and his crickets.
My Lord, all of my kisses, you don't know what you've been, I bet you know, boy.
Crickets? Crickets chirp in the background, but Holly was all foreground. And this sound did come from somewhere. You can hear it. There's Southern Mississippi blues.
When you went away at me all alone, while you played around, I waited at home. Don't come back knocking. And my heart's closed.
You can kind of hear Lawrence Welk in this attempt by the recording industry to make Holly a crooner.
Going faster than a roller coaster, love like yours will surely come my way.
But it was the raw stuff that really stuck.
Oh, hell, the little things you say and do make me want to be with you. Rave on, it's a crazy feeling.
Guitar chords that sound like bullet ricochets, lyrics that come from another time, another world. Rave on, 1957. Or the names of girls you can't help but fall in love with.
If you knew Peggy Sue, then you know why I feel blue without Peggy.
And then in 1959, 50 years ago today, it was all over. As some would say, as some do say, the music died.
Three teenage rock and roll singers and a pilot were killed today when their chartered airplane crashed in a light snowstorm northwest of Mason City, Iowa. The singers were identified as 22-year-old Buddy Holly, 21-year-old Richie Valens, and J.P. Richardson, known professionally as the Big Bopper.
When you say goodbye, yes, that'll be the day. When you make me cry, you say you're gonna leave. You know it's a lie, cause that'll be the day when I die.
50 years later to the day, the tragedy still resonates. The loss of Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper still stings. But for the music, that day still hasn't come.
Tell me maybe that someday we'll all be through. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave. You know it's a lie, cause that'll be the day when I die.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 3rd, and Femi Okay is with us to get us all caught up on the latest headlines.
Hello there. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. North Korea appears ready to test a missile capable of hitting the United States. A South Korean news agency reports a sighting of a train carrying what appears to be a missile and that Korean intelligence believes it's a model powerful enough to strike the western US. It could take several weeks for the missile to be ready for launch. The rocket that hit Israel today is far smaller than a missile but still capable of creating a lot of trouble. It came from Gaza and nobody was hurt. Israel and Hamas both stopped major combat 2 weeks ago. But there have still been some sporadic attacks on both sides. Israel promises a military response in Gaza to any incoming rockets, and all this as Hamas visits Egypt for talks on building a lasting truce. North Korea and the Middle East are just a couple of problems that the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, will inherit. Today she will have her first face-to-face meeting with top European allies. The foreign ministers from Germany and the UK will talk with her in Washington. Tom Daschle can't join Clinton in the cabinet unless the Senate confirms him as health secretary. Recent revelations about tax troubles have made his nomination more of a fight than expected. Daschle met privately with senators yesterday. He has also apologized and paid back taxes and interest. President Obama is still backing Daschle. And finally, Chinese Prime Minister Wen Jiabao faced protesters at Cambridge University yesterday. The protests took a very bizarre turn when the Chinese Prime Minister's speech on global warming was interrupted. So you hear the interruption. Now listen out for a shoe. Did you hear that double bang?
That was the shoe?
That was the shoe being thrown on stage at Cambridge University of all places. Now, the Chinese delegation complained to the British government over the incident, and the shoe missed Mr. Wen, but he said that his friendship between China and the UK would not be damaged, what he called an act of despicable behaviour. The shoe thrower has been charged and he will be in court next week.
Thank you, Femi. John Hockenberry is at our member station, or a member station, KUOW-KXOT, and that's in Seattle. And he'll be on the West Coast all week for our series, Power Trip. He's taking a look at the future of energy and some of the innovations that are currently taking place. And we're asking you today, what's the one thing you just can't give up, or you refuse to give up to save energy? Or what obstacles are in place that keep you, you think, from changing? Doris writes to us, like a majority of middle-class citizens of this country, I am way too attached to my automobile. Unlike a majority of people, I do have an option of carpooling or public transit, but it takes longer. And in the cold and snow of winter, it is so much more convenient to pop in my little car and burn fossil fuels. Thank you, Doris, for your honesty. What about you? What's your thought on preserving energy? You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now we're going to talk about the National Security Agency, or the NSA, which traditionally has preferred to keep a very low profile.
Halfway between Baltimore and Washington, D.C., is a hidden city, the headquarters of the National Security Agency, NSA. Here, tens of thousands of mathematicians, computer scientists, analysts, linguists, and voice interceptors work in absolute secrecy.
For those in the know, the joke was always that NSA stood for no such agency. For those on the inside, the joke was that NSA stood for never say anything.
The NSA has gotten a lot of publicity, or it did during the Bush administration. In 2005, the nation learned that in response to the 9/11 attacks, President Bush had authorized it to wiretap phones and email communications of U.S. citizens. What you just heard came from the new Nova documentary, The Spy Factory, which details how the NSA had the potential to prevent the 9/11 attacks and how it subsequently violated the privacy of millions of Americans. Joining us to talk about the new Nova documentary, which is a production of our partners WGBH Boston, is journalist James Bamford. James wrote and co-produced the documentary, and it's based on his book, The Shadow Factory. Welcome back and good morning, James.
Good morning.
Now, you've actually written three books on the NSA, and some people describe you as the official biographer of the agency. That sound right to you?
Well, I'd say it's unofficial biographer. I've written three books on NSA, but it's an agency that's so secret that nobody inside ever writes any books, unlike the CIA, where you have almost every director and senior official coming out writing a book.
Let's hear a little bit more from your documentary.
NSA's job, to secretly listen in on telephone conversations, email communications, anything and everything that might warn of plots to do harm.
The scope of what happens at NSA is mind-boggling. I don't think the average person can even begin to conceive of the staggering depth and breadth of what they have to do.
But was NSA doing its job before the 9/11 attacks? It's a question that has never been thoroughly investigated.
And that's the question, James, that you look into. And what did you discover?
Well, you know, the NSA has this enormous ability to collect information. And before 9/11, it managed to collect telephone conversations of several of the hijackers who were actually here in the United States. And at one point, the hijackers decided to change their location and move their final operations base to Laurel, Maryland, which happens to be the same place that NSA is located. So for 6 weeks, you had the NSA intercept operators, the people looking for the terrorists, and the terrorists themselves living in the same town, exercising in the same gyms, shopping in the same grocery stores, and so forth. So I thought that was extraordinary coincidence that would happen. And then you have an agency that you were paying $10 billion a year for that didn't see the terrorists who were right among them at the same time.
And what do you hope people learn from the documentary?
Well, what I really hope is that the public will get a little better understanding of this agency that very few people know anything about. And it has a lot of potential for helping the U.S. in terms of finding terrorists, but it also has a lot of potential for damaging the U.S. In terms of civil liberties and so forth. And that's what happened when the Bush administration went into this program of warrantless eavesdropping, which was against the law. The law called for getting a warrant before you eavesdrop on U.S. citizens, and the Bush administration bypassed that.
Well, James, one of the amazing legacies of the Bush administration is a transformation of Americans' perception of the NSA from something that is super secret to almost an expectation that the NSA is actually spying on all of us as U.S. citizens. And, you know, the Barack Obama administration wants to roll back Gitmo and stop, you know, torture of interrogations. But is it possible to roll back NSA domestic spying once they start listening?
No, it's pretty difficult. I think the positive things that have happened is they have, after the warrantless eavesdropping was going on, the Congress enacted a new bill, changed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act a bit so that there is more protection. But there's still...
And Obama voted for it, right?
Right. He opposed it at first because he didn't want to give immunity to the telecommunications companies that helped the NSA, and then eventually he did vote for it. Right now, the NSA is under some control by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, but it's there's still a lot of questions about how much control the court has over NSA and how much NSA is actually eavesdropping. You know, almost everything coming into the United States is filtered through NSA's computers and their software. And when you think how much information that is and how many conversations that the NSA could capture, it gets very mind-boggling, I think, at times.
James Bamford, we thank you for joining us this morning. Your documentary truly is chilling. James Bamford wrote and co-produced the documentary, which is called The Spy Factory. It's a Nova production produced by WGBH, our partners in Boston. And it airs tonight on Nova. You just check your local PBS stations for listings. Get that out there. So John Hockenberry is at member station KUOW and KXOT in Seattle. He'll be on the West Coast all week for our series Power Trip, a look at the future of energy. He's taking a look at all kinds of innovations. And we're asking you today, what's the one thing you just can't give up? Or maybe you just refuse to give it up to save energy? Or what obstacles do you think exist that keep you from changing? Here's what John in Wellfleet thinks.
We're now a small business, and we need our van to get around from one place to another for art shows. We can't get any more efficient than something that gets 18 or 19 to a gallon, and it hurts.
Here's an obstacle. What about you? What obstacles are you facing? Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's a thought today on a takeaway.
I think the Chinese government kind of likes people to go back where they came from because then links with other workers are much, much weaker.
That's Dr. Carrie Brown, Senior Fellow in Asia Research for the Chatham House in London, talking about rural migrant workers in China. You can go to our website, thetakeaway.org. If you missed anything, I'm Adora Udoji. It's The Takeaway.
Is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
In Seattle, Washington, Jacob Locke is mourning the loss of his school.
It's a program for people that are different, that can't function normally. And Summit is a good school for people who can't function normally, I think. And I'm really not sure if Nova's going to be the same.
Nova will be his new school. His old one is closing, along with others in Seattle. Hard times for schools. That's coming up on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 3rd. And hey, John Hockenberry, you're in Seattle, right?
Good morning. Yes, with an emotional story about some very tough choices in some local communities. We'll have more on that school story in a minute. I'm also out here reporting for Power Trip, our special coverage of the future of energy. More about that later.
And good morning to John, and good morning to all of you this hour. We'll talk about those tough times for schools John mentioned and the tough choices leaders and parents have to make. We'll also have a conversation with a top Republican to find out what it takes to get his party to back the president's stimulus package. Those stories are coming up, but first these headlines. Today is the next round of wrangling over President Obama's economic stimulus package. The bill is in the Senate today. The president wants Republican votes, so watch for tweaks to get a buy-in from them. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell says for his party, change must begin at home.
We believe, Republicans, that a stimulus bill must fix the main problem first, and that's housing. That's how all of this began. We think you ought to go right at housing first.
Republican ideas to do that include measures to cut the cost of mortgages and give bigger tax credits to homebuyers. New Hampshire Republican Senator Judd Gregg is eyeing a career out of Congress. President Obama will officially tap him as Commerce Secretary today. And it took a lot of wheeling and dealing to make this happen. New Hampshire's governor is a Democrat, but Gregg said he would not take the cabinet post if the governor filled his seat with a Democrat. The governor is now expected to pick a Republican who will agree to not run for re-election. So Gregg's appointment will not change the Senate balance of power. Femi Okeke is here with a look at the morning's other top stories.
Hello there. Good morning. Let's stay on the Obama cabinet news for a bit with this announcement. It gets one more member.
The ayes are 75, the noes are 21, and the nomination is confirmed.
That's the Senate vote to confirm Eric Holder as the first black attorney general in history. He'll be sworn in the next hour. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has her first face-to-face meetings with top European allies. The foreign ministers from Germany and the UK will talk with her in Washington. The battle in Pakistan's volatile northwest is hotter today. Militants blew up a key bridge there, cutting off a major supply route for US troops in neighboring Afghanistan. Getting materials to troops has been a major issue there. Adora.
Thank you, Femi. Wall Street opens at the bottom of the hour. The Dow will begin this morning below 8,000. It fell nearly 1% yesterday to close at 79.36. The S&P starts at 8.25. John Hockenberry is at member station KUOW, KXOT in Seattle, and he's there on the West Coast for our Power Trip series, a look at the future of energy. What are you doing to save energy? What do you refuse to do to save energy? Email us, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're out here in Seattle. And Adora, you know, not a week goes by in the last really half year that we haven't been talking about all the tough choices that are facing legislators in Congress, of course, the new president at the White House, but also in corporate boardrooms and straight down to state houses and city halls. Communities are facing tough times by having to deal with very tough choices. And while we're out here in Seattle, we thought we would take a look at one story of some tough choices concerning Seattle schools and decisions that are being acutely felt in some African-American neighborhoods. And we're joined now by Phyllis Fletcher, a reporter for KUOW, the public radio station serving the Puget Sound region, in the studios right where I am now. Phyllis, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
This is an emotional story here in the city of Seattle about the closing of five schools. No you know, insignificant detail for a city of a half million, right?
Yeah, I would say so. There's, in the end, five schools closing means about 1,700 kids are going to have to find a different school to go to next year.
And to give us some perspective on how unusual this is for a community, we've got Michelle McNeil with us, who's a writer for Education Week. She joins us from Baltimore, Maryland, from the studios of WEAA. Michelle, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Well, first of all, Phyllis, let's meet some people who had a reaction to what was really a shocker of a story here in Seattle when it broke.
Yeah, let's meet a mom from Cooper Elementary School in West Seattle. It's a school that serves mostly poor children. It's a pretty well-integrated school. It's one of those schools that, like when Jonathan Kozol came to Seattle about 8 years ago, the district like propped it up as an example for him to come and do his photo op and as part of his book tour. And he praised this school as being the kind of school that had the facilities and programs that poor children don't normally get access to. And here we hear from a mom whose son goes to Cooper, and she's already been through the school district's last school closure process, so you can hear that she's a little fed up at this point.
I hate to think that my son will have to go to one more school before he's even in middle school. This will be number four if this school closes this year. That's ridiculous. And as a parent, I mean, I want him to be in a school that meets his needs academically, you know, educationally, I mean, and just supports him. And this school, we found it here. And now, you know, it's upsetting, to say the least.
Wow.
Yeah.
Set the scene. What was this meeting like that you were?
Well, this was a public hearing at Cooper Elementary. It's required by state law. Board members have to attend it when a school building is going to be closed. And parents had the opportunity to get up and speak, and a lot of them sounded just like her. The little jazz band at Cooper played. The janitor got up and spoke and specifically thanked the white people for coming and sending their kids to a school. He feels that integration is a key to moving forward in education. That was the tone of this meeting.
Well, let's talk about some of the issues that are behind this. Is it budget cuts? Is it sort of racial demographics changing in the city? What's the rationale for closing these, you know, what sound like community centers?
The rationale is budget cuts that are coming from the state, the general downturn in the economy, and also the need to overall improve education. The superintendent believes that by doing some restructuring, she'll be able to improve some of these schools.
Michelle McNeil from Education Week, how unusual is it for a budgetary crisis to precipitate in the actual closure of schools in a way that is really causing so much trauma here in some neighbors in Seattle?
Sadly, I don't think it's that uncommon, and I think it's going to get all the more common as school districts continue to make tough decisions in terms of their own budgets, just like we're all doing, you know, at home with our budgets. And school buildings are expensive to operate, and especially in big districts that have a lot of buildings, they can move kids around pretty easily. So I think this is a sign of things to come, unfortunately.
Michelle, how does this play out politically? I mean, we've certainly heard the story of base closings and how, you know, suddenly bases are like the most important thing to the economic tax base of a community. And they're closed, then they're open, then they're closed, then they're open. Do schools that are slated for closing generally close, or is there some last minute appeal and there's always having your cake and eating it too politically?
I think you see it based community by community. You have a lot of a lot of it depends on how strong your parent groups are. If you have some really powerful parents at a particular school, sometimes they can sway the school board. But I think things are very different right now. I think there's a lot less leeway in school districts to decide to keep open schools. Schools don't have a lot of choices on where to cut, you know, and closing school buildings is a a natural thing to consider. So politically, a lot of parents don't have a lot of other options. If a school district says we're closing, you know, they're going to have to go to the school where the district tells them to go.
Well, the federal government theoretically has $150 billion worth of stimulus money, Phyllis, on its way to localities like Seattle. Is there any sense that parents or educators or politicians in Seattle believe that money is on the way, resources are on the way?
Well, you know, a lot of people brought that up, but the superintendent kept coming back to, you know, this is also a matter of the fact that we have declining enrollment and we have a lot of empty seats now, and we just can't afford, it's not sustainable to keep these schools open when they're almost half empty. But, you know, people are very attached to their schools, and Michelle's right. A lot of parents are successful in getting their schools off a closure list, specifically if they have an organized PTA with money. Those schools repeatedly get off the list. Some of those schools have been on a closure list three times in the last 5 years in Seattle, and they keep getting off.
So it's a long sort of narrative with lots of twists and turns. Let's meet some other folks that you met at that meeting who can describe a little bit of the racial politics that are behind some of this school closing issue.
Yeah, you know, there was this funny thing that happened at the final school closure meeting where they had heightened security. They were enforcing all their rules. And one of their rules, supposedly, that I'd never heard of before, but a new rule that night was no standing, although about a dozen people stood during the entire meeting. But the district chose to enforce the rule on one person. And the media immediately jumped up and followed him out. And this is why.
Because the only reason anybody's paying attention right now is because I happen to be the president of Seattle King County branch of the NAACP. The only reason that people are paying attention right now is because I've suggested that perhaps litigation needs to be filed against this particular school district.
Oops. So the school district accidentally, maybe, kicked out from its meeting the president of the Seattle chapter of the NAACP. And the lawsuit he was referring to would be a lawsuit that would possibly keep some of these schools open, he hopes. It has not been filed yet, but he's concerned because a lot of the schools that did end up staying on the closure list primarily serve black kids and or poor kids.
I want to ask you this question first, Phyllis, and then I want to ask Michelle, because Adora and I talk about this as we are trying to evaluate the stimulus package all the time, that the motivation for the stimulus package, $900 billion or whatever, is to save the economy. But all of a sudden, in a bill like that, with a crisis like that, there are opportunities for other things to throw things into the bill which maybe aren't directly related. Do you see an opportunity, a crisis opportunity being taken by educators and state politicians in Seattle that partially motivates the closing of these schools?
You know, it could be, because that is something that's always brought up in this round of closures. But Seattle also had school closures in 2006, and those closures were initially proposed in 2005. So our superintendents here have tried to close schools a number of times just in the last few years, just based on our overall declining enrollment.
Michelle, give us the last word. Is it possible that a crisis is going to be cover for politicians to make some steps they wouldn't have maybe the guts to do in another time?
I think that very well could be the case. This gives them, you're right, political cover to make tough decisions that they wouldn't otherwise be able to make, that would be unpopular and undoable in other times. But as we all know, these are extraordinary times, so there might be some extraordinary decisions being made.
Well, as we see, an emotional story here in Seattle, Washington, with the closure of five schools. And again, we don't know what the outcome is. It's just beginning. But a national trend, if we're to believe Michelle McNeil, that you know, communities around the nation are going to be facing these same kinds of issues. Michelle McNeil, writer for Education Week, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Phyllis Fletcher, right here in the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Thanks so much for bringing this story to light for our national audience. Thanks so much, Phyllis.
You're welcome.
John, it's clearly a trend. I mean, it's not just public schools, but also private schools. We looked at some Catholic schools a couple of weeks ago, and there are Catholic school closures across the country also happening.
It's interesting, this crisis cover to make tough political decisions that, you know, are kind of under the radar because everyone's looking at the big picture. That's an interesting trend, it seems to me.
And it sounds very difficult.
Well, it's an emotional story here in Seattle, and it was all over the front pages when we got here, that's for sure.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm joining you today from Seattle, Washington, here at member station KUOW and KXOT in Seattle. All week long, we're on the West Coast for our series Power Trip, which is a look at the future of energy and the science that it takes to change energy policy. And we're asking you today a more personal question. What's the one thing you can't give up or won't give up to save energy? And what's the obstacle that keeps you from changing? Margo has a great story. I unplug my cable box during the day and overnight unless I'm planning to tape something important. The box stays extremely hot, even in standby mode, so I'm religious about this despite the 5 to 7 minute boot up time when I plug it back in. I do not, however, unplug my teenage daughter's cable box since it doesn't seem worth the hysteria it would cause. Tell us your thoughts. You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Good call, Margo.
There are limits to saving energy. We're going to move to Africa, where today the heads of state from the 53 African nations are in the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa for the African Union Summit. Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi has been named the 2009 chairman. He's proposed the formation of a pan-African government that would form a United States of Africa. For a look at what that might mean, we're joined by Lydia Polgreen, West Africa Bureau Chief of the New York Times, who has been covering the summit, and she joins us from Dakar, Senegal. Good morning. I should say good afternoon to you, Lydia.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
How did Gaddafi get elected, since for so many years, African leaders have considered him erratic?
I think that what it really shows more than anything is that there's a real leadership vacuum on the African continent. For a long time, Gaddafi has really wanted to take control of the African Union. He was one of the main backers of creating the new African Union. So he's really, really wanted to sort of shape this in his own image. But what has held him back are a handful of quite influential heads of state, like Thabo Mbeki from South Africa, Olusegun Obasanjo from Nigeria, and a few others who are extremely influential on the world stage and managed to kind of hold Gaddafi in check and keep, you know, sort of his slightly, what many people see as a slightly zany hope for African unity off the main agenda at the African Union and deal with what they saw as more pragmatic business. But, these leaders have now, you know, either been pushed off or stepped off the stage. And so what you found is that there's a real vacuum of strong voices within the African Union to oppose somebody like Gaddafi, who is, you know, quite good at manipulating situations to get his own way.
And along that line, one of his primary platforms is that notion you mentioned of the United States of Africa, this notion of African unity, which some members of the AU have been against for many years. What is Gaddafi's plan?
Well, it's not really clear what his plan is, and whether he really thinks that it's something that could be achieved in any sort of short order. This idea has been around for a long time. Of course, you know, African states were created by colonial powers that arbitrarily drew lines that crossed ethnic borders and things like that. And many of Africa's problems are traced to these borders that don't really make any kind of ethnic or political sense. But at the same time, these states have been around now for half a century, and they're used to governing themselves. So there's been a longstanding Pan-African ideal of joining Africa together so that it could have the same kind of weight on the global stage as, say, Europe or China or India, because all these little countries don't have the same kind of weight that one big country could. Not all countries are united on this. Many of them have different styles of government, different kinds of attitudes towards various players in the world. So how Gaddafi would actually get this, 53 different countries to set aside their own sort of statehood and join up with him. It's hard to imagine how that could happen anytime in our lifetimes, for sure.
Lydia, do economists or academics or anyone sort of outside the Gaddafi orbit give any credibility or even suggest the practicality of a continent-wide economic entity called the United States of Africa?
Well, I don't think that you would see a lot of mainstream thinkers embracing the idea or thinking that it's practical or possible. But this is a very old idea. It dates back to before the independence era. Kwame Nkrumah was a great the first leader of Ghana. Independent Ghana was a great father of this idea. And I think that there is a general consensus that African states on their own, most of them are too small, too weak, to really make a great deal of economic or political progress on their own. So I think there's agreement that some form of unity and the ability for the continent to act in unison is important, just in the way that the European Union has given what are ultimately some quite small countries quite a bit more influence on the global stage. So I think that it's not a crazy idea to have an African Union that can allow Africa to have a bigger voice in global affairs. But I think that what Gaddafi is proposing is something that is beyond what anyone thinks is within the realm of possibility.
And I have to say, Lydia, that it was classic Gaddafi when he sent out a letter before he got to the AU meeting calling himself the King of Kings. Lydia Polgreen, thank you so much for joining us. Lydia is the West Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and she was reporting on the proposed formation of a Pan-African government. She was reporting from Senegal. Now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got some headlines for us.
Hello there. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. And Adora, wouldn't you love to interview Gaddafi?
I think it would be very interesting.
Definitely. We'll keep his number, see if he'd give us a call one day. So let me catch up with some headlines for this morning. Senate Democrats could add billions of additional dollars targeting infrastructure projects to the economic stimulus package. Money for highway projects alone could get an almost 50% boost to $40 billion. President Obama is keeping his schedule loose this week to talk to senators as they debate his stimulus plan. Today, he used some of that unscheduled time to conduct interviews with the major news networks. Also making the rounds on TV today, another former Illinois politician, Governor Rod Blagojevich. He'll be on Letterman tonight. The Palestinian Authority has recognized the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. The move is aimed at allowing an investigation of possible war crimes during the recent Gaza conflict. But Israel has never recognized the court's jurisdiction. Former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick is out of jail. He was released very early this morning after serving a 99-day sentence. He pleaded guilty in October to two counts of obstruction of justice and no contest to a felony charge of assaulting a court officer. He was 25 pounds lighter and sporting a heavy beard. Has a look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thanks very much for me.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Hello, everybody, from Puget Sound, Seattle, Washington, here at member station KUOW and KXOT. On the West Coast all this week for our series Power Trip, a look at the future of energy. And it's a future that involves individual choices and some very interesting science. So we're asking you today, what's the one thing you can't give up or won't give up to save energy? What's the trade-off in your household? John has an interesting one. He writes, "My wife and I are artists and own a small business. We've given up a lot for the sake of energy conservation, but we still need to use a not-too-energy-efficient cargo van to transport all our work and show materials." Those trade-offs are interesting. There's a story behind every single one. Tell us yours. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Adora?
Well, that was a nice segue from our listener, because we're going to talk about art now. Brandeis University, the only non-sectarian Jewish-sponsored university in the country, has been hit hard by the economic downturn, in particular the Bernie Madoff scandal. The college had not invested with Madoff, but many of its donors did. And because of that, the university's endowment has dropped roughly 23%. And in face is an immediate budget shortfall of a reported $10 million. Staff positions are being eliminated and scholarships are on the line. But one of the most controversial plans is the announcement by the president, Yehuda Reinhartz, that Brandeis will close the university's Rose Art Museum and sell off 6,000 pieces of art. Is it a case of tough decisions for tough times, or has Brandeis gone too far? Jonathan Lee is the chairman of the Board of Overseers at the Rose Art Museum and joins us this morning. Welcome and good morning, Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
Please describe the art museum's collection.
Well, this is a world-class asset, and it is the largest collection of modern and contemporary art in New England and has a very storied history in contemporary art and a litany of truly outstanding shows, and they have a history of lending their works across a huge spectrum of museums. There is a picture right now at the Guggenheim in a show that opened on Thursday.
We're talking about Andy Warhol's, Roy Lichtenstein's, Jasper Johns, among other great artists, right?
Yes. Every storied name in modern art is in the collection just about.
How long did it take to put the collection together?
The museum was founded in 1961 and has been very fortunate to have a string of outstanding directors and an enormous coterie of philanthropists that have been incredibly generous. And this is, in my mind, a cultural and artistic legacy of post-war American Jews who got over the shock of the war, became wealthy, collected art, and at the same time became philanthropists. So there's an intellectual history there that, apart from just the art itself, that's quite interesting.
And what has the reaction been from the university community as well as those donors you mentioned at the thought of selling off all of those contributions?
Well, I've because I seem to be at the wrong place at the wrong time as chairman of the Board of Overseers, have heard from lots and lots of very angry donors, and my phone really hasn't stopped ringing. People are really in shock and dismayed across the board, and really across the country and on campus.
Mr. Lee, though, in times of economic hardship, and certainly Brandeis is not to be blamed for the unfortunate entanglement with the Madoff scandal. But, can you tell us how integrated, if at all, the university collection is with student activity and student learning so that the argument can possibly be made that if it doesn't have that kind of integration, maybe it really should be considered part of the endowment and should help bail out the educational operations of the school?
Well, I don't think the people that gave the art feel that way. And there are assets on a balance sheet, and it is very easy because of the run-up in the art market and all the press it's received to think that this is an asset that would be like any other asset class in an endowment. But this is more the soul of the university and the cultural patrimony. Many people have written that they've walked by the university, they've known it's there, and they've had intangible takeaway. But to answer your question directly, there are 400 students that show up to the openings. There are jazz programs every Sunday. There are innumerable lectures. There's a full array of educational programming that goes on there, and I think it is a very important teaching asset at the university.
Who actually owns the art, Jonathan, and what are the
issues?
What
a wonderful question.
Yeah, who actually owns it, and what are some of the issues that might be involved if the university did try to sell it?
So, obviously, the university says that we own it. And there are those of us, in the greater community who say, no, this is not yours to sell. The feeling that when somebody gives art to a museum, they expect the museum to operate going forward and to operate within the code of conduct that, that museums operate. There is a strict code of ethics that museums do not sell artwork for operating funds. They sell artwork when they do deaccession to return those funds back into art of similar or higher quality. So the museum, in essence, acts as a steward for future generations of students and the general public.
Sounds like things could get a little tricky. Jonathan Lee, we thank you for joining us this morning with your story. Jonathan Lee is the chairman of the Board of Overseers at the Rose Art Museum at Brandeis University. And he was responding to the announcement by the university's president of potentially selling 6,000 pieces of art in the museum. Now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got some headlines for us. Hey, Femi.
Hello there, Teodora. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. A government official says that militants have blown up a bridge in northwest Pakistan, temporarily cutting a major supply line for troops in Afghanistan. Now, it's not clear if there's a way to bypass the now-destroyed bridge. Tom Daschle is apologizing for the scandal surrounding his unpaid taxes. Daschle told the Senate Finance Committee it was inadvertent and unintentional, but also inexcusable. He says he hopes his mistake will be considered in light of his 30 years of public service, and it doesn't look likely to derail his chances to become the next Secretary of Health and Human Services. Iran says that it's put its first domestically built satellite into orbit. State television showed pictures of the launch of a rocket, which it says carries the OMID satellite designed for research and telecommunications. In Australia, a judge has ordered the leader of a terrorist cell to spend at least 12 years in prison. Prosecutors said that Algerian-born cleric Abdel Nasser Benbrika plotted to attack major sporting events with the goal of killing at least 1,000 people. No attacks took place, but officials say the group had targeted locals for violent jihad. And a new study suggests that scientists have found a very strong link between the causes of Alzheimer's and the hormone insulin. Professor William Klein from Northwestern University explains the connection.
These toxins that we think cause Alzheimer's disease make brain cells resistant to insulin. And that's essentially a type 3 diabetes, where the brain is becoming resistant to insulin.
Researchers believe that treating Alzheimer's with insulin or with drugs to boost the hormone's effect may help patients, and some diabetic drugs may even be able to treat Alzheimer's. As a look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Thanks very much, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry, joining you from our member station KOW and KXOT in Seattle. There is a global story brewing this morning, and it's related to the economic stimulus plan that's now being debated in the U.S. Senate. There's a Buy American clause in the multi-billion dollar package that would try to ensure that only U.S. iron, steel, and manufactured goods are used in infrastructure projects paid for in the stimulus package. The European Union says it will launch a complaint with the World Trade Organization if the clause remains. Well, how huge is this story? We decided to check with Andrew Walker, BBC Economics and business correspondent. Andrew, it's certainly not the first time that in economic crisis, nations have turned to a kind of protectionist mantra. How destabilizing does the EU think this is?
The EU, it must be said, is genuinely concerned, and they're talking about the risk of a kind of tit-for-tat kind of response developing around the world with a kind of wave of rising barriers to international trade. It has to be said that, you could argue that the European Union is not itself entirely blameless in this. The Director General of the World Trade Organization recently did a little report on signing signs of rising protectionism in response to the financial and economic crisis. And he did mention one particular measure taken by the European Union, the plan to reintroduce certain export subsidies on some dairy produce. But, you know, I have to say that the view, I think certainly the EU steel industry is getting very concerned about the possibility of these provisions in the in the U.S. stimulus legislation.
Andrew, you're something of an economist yourself. I mean, it's certainly the case that global recessions have been brought about by precisely these kinds of clauses proliferating in nations who are formerly trading partners.
Well, it's certainly the case that many economists take the view that at the very least, the proliferation of trade protectionism was something that aggravated the Great Depression back in the 1930s. I mean, most, I think, would take the view that it was not the principal cause, but very many would argue that that it aggravated what was already going to be a rather nasty downturn. And, of course, the Smoot-Hawley tariff legislation in the U.S. is often cited as being one of the key stages in that process. Worth emphasizing, though, a very important difference here. What the stimulus, the Buy America proposals in the stimulus legislation do is not directly attack imports. It's rather favoring locally produced American steel manufactured goods and so forth. And nor do they actually have a bearing on trade that's already underway in the way in which the Smoot-Hawley legislation did. It's more about ensuring that new spending
future,
under the stimulus
package
is directed mainly towards American producers.
Andrew Walker, BBC's economics and business correspondent, helping us to sort out the potential of damage economically that a Buy American clause in stimulus packages around the world could have to global trade.
Markets just opened about 15 minutes ago, trading, and they're essentially flat this morning. Oil prices slipped today with benchmark crude trading just below $40 a barrel after grim U.S. economic news weighed on the market overnight. There's your market update.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 3rd, and Femi Okeh has joined us with the morning's latest headlines. Hey, Femi.
Hello there to you, Adora. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. New Hampshire Republican Senator Judd Gregg is in line to be the next GOP member of the Obama cabinet. The president is set to nominate him as Commerce Secretary today. Now, complicated talks brought this around. New Hampshire's governor is a Democrat, but Gregg said that he wouldn't leave the Senate if a Democrat replaced him. Now, the governor is expected to pick a Republican who won't run for re-election, so Gregg's appointment won't change the Senate balance of power. We'll be doing tests later to see if you follow that. Also in the cabinet, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has her first face-to-face meetings with some of the top European allies to the US today. The foreign ministers from Germany and the UK will talk with her in Washington. Former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick is now free. He left prison early this morning after serving 99 days for corruption. He's now on probation, and his lawyers say that his focus is finding a job. He actually has an interview lined up with a Texas company tomorrow, but said that much about the job prospect or name the company, he's keeping quiet about that. Now, it's an orange alert at Alaska's Mount Redoubt, and that means the volcano could erupt at any time. Geologists still expect the mountain to blow, even though it's been a little quieter lately. Seismologist Celso Reyes from the Alaska Volcano Observatory says that he's expecting some visual warning signs before an eruption.
We would expect an increase in the earthquakes, an increase in tremor amplitude, in the earthquake amplitude and the earthquake frequency.
And just to be cautious, planes are being diverted around the peak and local emergency managers are on standby. And now back to John in Seattle.
Thank you, Femi. So at the beginning of this hour, we talked about how an economic crisis and a political crisis in America may be cover for some very difficult decisions in the local community of Seattle, Washington. We're going to take a look at that in the stimulus package that's now being debated in the U.S. Senate on Capitol Hill. And President Obama talked about it's on the line now for the Republicans and Democrats to get together.
The important thing is getting the thing passed. And I've done extraordinary outreach, I think, to Republicans because they have some good ideas. And I want to make sure that those ideas are incorporated.
Well, outreach, bipartisanship, that's being tested on Capitol Hill this week. And also the nature of the stimulus package itself is being debated. And joining us now, we are grateful to have Senator Charles Grassley, the U.S. Senator from Iowa, Republican Senator from Iowa. Senator Grassley, it's so nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, John, glad to be with you and Adora.
Let me just ask right off the top here. Is it possible that the bill, as it's coming together, is looking a little bit more like an opportunity for lawmakers to get involved in programs that maybe they wouldn't have been able to do without the cover of this crisis? And so that's why this bill is looking as complex as it is at this point?
The extent to which there is money or tax policy in here that goes way beyond the two-year period that we want the stimulus to stimulate, or the extent to which there are projects in here that are just personal for a single district, the answer is yes. And it goes beyond the purpose of a stimulus package, which is to create jobs. Maybe some of those other things I talked about create jobs. But if you create jobs for 2 years and the program's ongoing and at the end of 2 years you're going to eliminate those jobs, I think we ought to concentrate on projects that are going to be done and over, and most of those would fall into the category of infrastructure.
All right, let's talk about the difference from the Republican perspective. And I know you don't speak for all Republicans, but insofar as you can, the difference between something that you feel is just purely for some individual lawmaker's district and something that actually has legitimate economic stimulative value.
Well, for instance, if you're going to sod the grass on the mall in Washington, D.C., and that would be done anyway, then should that be in a stimulus package? I mean, there's certain upkeep that government has to do every year. Why would you use a stimulus package for an excuse? Or if you're going to extend the Head Start program for 55,000 kids, which probably needs to be done, and you're going to hire teachers, but why would you do that in a stimulus bill if at the end of the stimulus bill it's not going to be continued beyond that? Should not a Head Start program decision to increase the number of kids and hire more teachers be done in the regular appropriation process where it would get long-term consideration and where it would be prioritized against other programs as opposed to sticking it in a stimulus package? No.
Well, let me use,
I think it's being in the stimulus package just because it wouldn't otherwise get done.
Let's look at an example that some Republicans have criticized, and that is Medicaid budgets, that the stimulus package would reimburse states for their strapped Medicaid budgets. Yeah. Isn't it stimulative for states to get the Medicaid cash that they need because it will free up resources for state business and state workers and state projects to actually get completed?
Yeah. Well, let's say there's a very important reason to put more money into Medicaid. There's X number of people going to be unemployed. They don't have health insurance. They turn to Medicaid, and we ought to provide that service for them. That's about $10 billion out of the $86 billion that's in the bill. Okay, then let's say we accept your argument, and I do, that there's certain other aid that ought to be given to states. Then why don't we just give that aid to states and not use the subterfuge of Medicaid to get the money to the states? Why don't
isn't it the same arithmetic?
If the states need money for education, give it for education. If they need it for building roads, give it for building roads, but not do it through the Medicaid program.
Isn't it the same mathematics, though, the same arithmetic?
But isn't it a little bit deceitful to the taxpayers to give money for health care when you don't, for the unemployed, when you only need about one-tenth of that amount of money? Isn't that deceitful? Shouldn't we be open and above board and very transparent? In fact, isn't that why we have the present economic crisis we're in? There's a credit crisis because there wasn't transparency in the banking business and the securities business.
Good point. Let's talk about what Barack Obama said in that clip that we played. He was speaking during a pre-Super Bowl interview with Matt Lauer, so everyone in the universe saw the interview probably. He said that Republicans have good ideas, and he wants to see them incorporated into this bill. Are any of your good ideas in this bill, Senator Grassley?
Yeah. We have every year we have a tax problem with the alternative minimum tax, where middle-income people are going to be hit by a tax that was only supposed to hit millionaires. And the committee adopted my amendment so that we don't hit those 24 million middle-income people. Now, is that stimulus? Not exactly, but when you have indefinite and uncertainty in tax policy, it's not good for the economy. Now, the only difference between Republicans and, well, there may be a lot of difference between Republicans and Democrats on spending money, but a major difference is Republicans would like to make sure that we have tax policy that encourages investment so that you create jobs in the private sector, because those jobs in the private sector are going to be long-term jobs, whereas right. the jobs we're talking about by spending money are only two-year jobs.
Well, it's certainly, I mean, very, very quickly, are you going to vote for it as it stands now?
Oh, no. Didn't vote for it out of committee. But because of what the president's saying and his desire to have a bipartisan bill, which Democrats in Congress didn't desire to have, with president pressure, we can probably put together a bipartisan bill that Republicans can vote for.
Well, certainly part of the debate, and you'll be right in the middle of it. Charles Grassley, Republican senator from Iowa, thank you so much for giving us a hint of the debate to come.
And John, thank you for that. John Hockenberry is right now at member station KUOW and KXOT in Seattle. He'll be on the West Coast all week for our series Power Trip, a look at the future of energy. And we're asking you today, what's the one thing you just can't give up or you refuse to give up to save energy? Laura writes to us, "For me, it's paper towels. I swear when I die," she says, "they won't bury me with jewels, nor books, nor photos. I will have my arms wrapped around a roll of paper towels. I conserve them. I buy recycled ones, but please don't make me use a sponge or dish towel to clean up messes." Well, there's her line in the sand. Thank you, Laura, for that. What about you? What's your line in the sand? What won't you do to save energy? You can email us at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. You can also go to our website to see videos of John's adventures on his West Coast power trip. And here's a takeaway from Senegal.
It's not a crazy idea to have an African Union that can allow Africa to have a bigger voice in global affairs. But I think that what Gaddafi is proposing is something that is beyond what anyone thinks is within the realm of possibility.
That's Lydia Polgreen, West Africa Bureau Chief of the New York Times, on the selection of Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi as chair of the African Union. I'm Adora Udoji. John Hockenberry's on the West Coast, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.